Greetings, friends. This is a Dhamma talk on right intention and holding in mind the recognition and abandonment of craving and clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas. This talk was presented at our Tuesday evening Dhamma class in Frenchtown, New Jersey on April 5th, 2016.
So, once again, good evening and welcome, everyone. How many of you read tonight's article on... on right intention, right thinking. And so the first half of the article gets into how wrong intention has led to some teachings that aren't in accordance with what the Buddha taught. And, you know, I talk a lot about that. So I'm not, the reason why I'm saying that is I'm going to skip probably the first half of the article and get into what's most important, or what I mostly want to talk about tonight, anyway, I guess is the best way to say it. But I will touch on that a little bit. And again, this is about halfway through the article. As the teachings of the Buddha spread from a small corner of northern India, the Buddha's original teachings were adapted and accommodated to fit cultural demands and individual views that would establish itself in concepts, views, and ideas into this altered Dharma. So the point of that is that even at the time of the Buddha, with the Buddha on the planet giving his teachings, there was still this strong need to accommodate these teachings to continue the the prevalence of including a self in anything spiritual. The Vedas had been around for quite a while, and even the Upanishads, which were written kind of as a Protestant view of the Vedas, still seek to establish the self in different realms. And that's been a common problem in most anything. It's a common, we were talking about it earlier, it's a common problem in the world. It's the ongoing problem of too much eye-making and too much need to establish and maintain an ego self. Even if it's on an individual level, it causes great conflict. But as the ego forms associations, it can happen on national and international levels too. So there was a strong belief or wrong view that the Buddhist teaching should be adapted and accommodated to fit any view. I come up across that all the time. And people will even cite things like the Kalama Sutta saying, well, the Buddha said to do this. The Buddha never said to do that. He was very, very specific about what he taught and why he taught it and how to practice the Dhamma. And he certainly didn't say, go do whatever you want. When he saw the arising of a self-referential ego personality in something, he immediately pointed it out and shot it down and said it's contrary to the goal. Many will point to the accommodations and adaptations that have been made to the Buddha's teaching, to the Buddha's original teachings, as proof that Buddhism must be adapted to fit any view that arises. And that's a very common belief in modern Buddhism. It's almost a sacred belief that we should make this anything that we want, and we can incorporate anything. We can incorporate psychological teachings and practices. We can incorporate other religions. One of the great Buddhist leaders almost insists that we should reconcile everything into one great world religion. And just as a side note, I think that's one of the reasons why we have such religious tension in the world, is because people that are extremists feel this pull to reconcile everything, and they feel they're going to lose their identity, and they fight back against it. It doesn't mean that we should accept it, but I think that's what happens. In the West, despite the lack of state-sponsored or influenced religion, the same adaptations to Buddhism to accommodate the influences of technological and theoretical science and modern pop psychology has occurred. Even the well-entrenched adapted forms of Buddhism have been further adapted to fit these new Western views. This has led to a very complicated thicket of views that many use to justify the many contradictory and often antagonistic views of modern Buddhism. The argument is that since no one can know for certain what the Buddha actually taught, then it is an individual view that determines Buddhist practice. So that point of view is also prevalent, but it only arises because people didn't do their due diligence and they didn't look. Are the Buddhist teachings still available today, and are they still applicable? And they certainly are. We talk about that every week here. This is not only a modern occurrence. There was a strong desire during the Buddha's teaching career to accommodate his teachings to fit individual or cultural views. The Buddha consistently stated the simple and direct purpose of his teaching. These are the Buddha's words from the Samyutta Nikaya. both formally and for all time, it is only dukkha that I describe and the cessation of dukkha that I teach. And he said that consistently. Of course, anyone can accommodate Buddhism and call it Dharma. Often the argument is made that modern problems are so complex or immediate that the original teachings are no longer relevant. This view can only arise from a hardened view determined to protect an ego personality while presenting the appearance of practicing modern Buddhism. Even a simple inquiry into the Four Noble Truths will show the profound relevance that these truths, first presented 2,600 years ago, have to modern human life. The problems are still the same. The cause of the problem is still the same, and so the path leading to the cessation of the problem still works. The problems of modern human life and their causes are described in the first two noble truths. The possibility of a solution and the path developing the solution are described in the third and fourth noble truth. Hello, David. Jambhukadika, the wanderer, asked the Buddha, what is the path? What is the practice for the full comprehension of these forms of stressfulness or dukkha? The Buddha replied, precisely this noble eightfold path, my friend, right view, right resolve, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is the path, this is the practice for the full comprehension of these forms of stressfulness. So there's a lot in that last sentence, and what he's pointing out is that this eightfold path is so we can understand at a deep penetrating level stress. But why is that? Some people will say, well, that's not nearly enough. I'm not going to base everything on just learning about stress until you understand what stress has done to all of us. It's the distraction that takes us out of living our lives moment by moment. It's the distraction that leads to mindlessness. An important question to ask here is what or who is holding the view that a modern Buddhism and what modern Buddhism should look like? What are the motivations and intentions underlying the need to adapt, alter, and further accommodate the Buddha's direct teachings? It took Siddhartha Gautama approximately 6 years of intense study and practice with some of the most advanced spiritual teachers of his time to understand that awakening was not a process of additional acquisitions of spiritual experience or intellectual knowledge. Through his severe ascetic practices, he developed what he described as a middle way between extreme views rooted in ignorance. He knew that accommodating the prevailing dharmas of his time would only lead to more confusion and suffering as they were all rooted in ignorance. The reason why I use dharma in this context and not saying religions of his time is there really weren't religions the way we would look at religions today, but there were a lot of different dharmas. In other words, individual teachers that were wandering around northern India and actually in other parts of the world, particularly Greece at the time, professing that they had the one true dharma. And so that was a common occurrence to see one teacher after another come through your town and say, I got the answer. And it was difficult for people to figure it out. And when they came to the Buddha, there's a few suttas like that where the town has come to the Buddha, says, we've listened to all these different teachers. How are we supposed to know? And the Buddha said, Ehipasipa, come and see for yourself. Here's my teachings. It's very simple to implement. Try it out and see if it works for you. And weigh it against the effectiveness of other teachings. So he wasn't, the point of that is he wasn't trying to say, well, it's all one thing, and whatever you do is fine. That would have, from the Buddhist standpoint, and with his knowledge, that would have been the cruelest thing he could do, to pacify people and say, oh, everything you do is fine, it's all wonderful, it all leads to the same thing. He said, no, it's not. Out of deep compassion and courage, and also the knowledge that he had, he said, no, it's not those other things. Try this out and see what you think. From great frustration, I'm talking about the Buddha now, from great frustration arising from the physical and emotional results of his ineffective search, Siddhartha generated the intention, the right intention, to abandon all impermanent and ignorant views and ideas that he had acquired. With right intention, he sat in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, determined to remain in meditation until he awakened. A human being, through his own right intention, became a Buddha. He would spend the next 45 years of his life teaching how all human beings could awaken, as he had. So, does anybody have any questions about that or how that whole thing has taken place? Okay. During meditation, as samadhi, non-distraction, deepened, Siddhartha clearly experienced the results of wrong view arising from ignorance. He gained true insight into dukkha, into suffering. As a direct result of his non-distracted mind state, Siddhartha was able to refine his thinking. He understood that the solution to the problem of dukkha, of disappointment, confusion, and suffering, was not to be found with yet another spiritual philosophy focused on external expressions of concepts arising from acquired temporary views. He also now understood that these hard and acquired views were rooted in ignorance, and that freedom from confusion and suffering required abandoning all ignorant views. And that relates directly to his teachings on anatta. What the Buddha was teaching in anatta is that what is commonly held as a self is anatta. It's not a self, including all these views that had been acquired since the beginning of time, because they've all been passed down and made into different systems, and people acquire them, including us in modern times. And once we acquire a view, it's very, very difficult to admit that maybe that's a wrong view. Maybe I'm mistaken in believing this, and to let it go and take on something else that might be, and often is, contradictory to our held views. That's really the difficulty in implementing this simple Eightfold Path. Right intention is occasionally translated to right thinking. Being mindful of the right intention to abandon all clinging inclines the mind to continually consider, rather than ignore or defend, clinging the ego personality to objects, views, and ideas. So we have to be willing to challenge our own beliefs. That's really a key in developing an understanding of the Dhamma. That's the beginning of right view. Remember, right view is the view initially that my views are, trying to use a gentle word rather than ignorant views, they don't have all the understanding I need for a happy and peaceful life continually. Another way of saying it is that it's ignorance of the Four Noble Truths is wrong view. So right view is accepting that the Four Noble Truths are in fact worth discovering and worth developing, and that the Eightfold Path will lead to cessation of the First Noble Truth, of dukkha. And that really is the beginning and the end of right view. Profound or super mundane right view is just an awakened mind that sees things clearly. But it begins with that initial decision that there's something here for me to learn, something here that is useful for me. The Buddha taught Four Noble Truths. He taught how to develop understanding of dukkha and release from clinging, how to practice and develop the Eightfold Path. In his own words, he taught the understanding of dukkha and the cessation of dukkha, nothing more. The Eightfold Path is a path that develops a refined way of thinking, free of the demands of an ego personality for constant distraction and constant establishment of the ego in every thought that occurs. The Buddha teaches through dependent origination that the belief that anatta is a self is rooted in ignorance that results in the confusion and suffering known as dukkha. We simply don't know who we are, and we don't know how we relate to the ever-changing world outside of ourselves. And because there's no footing for the ego self in reality, it's constantly grasping to establish itself, or it feels like it will be annihilated. And that's one of the big things that I think every one of us has come across when we start taking to the Dhamma. What's going to happen to me? When I let go of all views, what happens to me? Everybody says that. Everybody's concerned about that. What happens is that you've let go of all views that are rooted in ignorance, and now you're living a life of deep wisdom and knowledge. Right intention is being mindful of the ego personality's need to constantly establish itself in every object, event, view, and idea. Anatta refuses to have a thought that is not self-referential and does not continue to establish itself. This is very subtle, and understanding this one point is the refined thinking that the Buddha achieved. That was the Buddha's aha moment, that he had been doing that up until the point that he awakened. Does that make sense? Do you see how every thought that the ego has is a self-referential thought, and that the ego sees itself in everything. Even as we're looking at someone else, we see other people in relation to how we see ourselves. Things as innocuous as a chair, when we, from the viewpoint of an ego personality, we'll look at a chair, and we don't just see a chair, we'll see a chair in relation to how we like chairs to be. I really don't like brown chairs. That chair would be better if it was blue. Or that chair shouldn't have a cushion. When we do that with completely innocuous things, and we also do it with very important things. But when we do it, what we're doing is changing the way we see the world. Then we're not seeing it clearly. We're seeing it through the viewpoint of a self-referential ego self. Does that make sense? And that's why those views that are rooted in anatta, not a self, are so confusing, and they so lead to suffering and stress. We're just simply not seeing things clearly, beginning with ourselves. For those that want to actually develop understanding and release through the Buddha's Dhamma, right intention shows that one must be willing to recognize and abandon the demands of an ego personality's insistence on accommodating the Buddha's teaching. to allow for further establishment of anatta as part of Buddhist practice. So again, it's getting back to my little rant on modern Buddhism, is that it has accommodated the ego personality rather than continue with what the Buddha taught was to end all self-referential views. Much of what's presented today in Buddhism and in the world in general is a way to maintain these self-referential views, even within a so-called Buddhist teaching. And the only reason I bring that up is that it's so subtle that we must be vigilant about what's our purpose here. Is our purpose to let go of all things that are anatta and awaken? Or is our purpose to just make ourselves feel better? There's much better ways of doing that than the Buddha's direct teachings. Ultimately, though, the Buddha develops a path that leads to lasting peace and happiness. It ends the reaction to constant stress. The refinement of thought is developed with shamatha vipassana meditation within the framework of the Eightfold Path. The process of refining thought is antagonistic to anatta, as anatta seeks to establish itself in each thought that occurs. This constant vigilance to see itself in all thoughts is the constant distraction arising from clinging mind. Anatta refuses to abandon any container for itself, including the conceptual containers of accommodated Buddhism. As all experiences are impermanent, the continual attempt at maintaining anatta results in constant tension and constant distraction. This constant vigilance of anatta maintains the inherent attachment to the disappointing nature of experience. So as long as we're seeking in our lives to satisfy an ego personality that can't be satisfied ultimately, there's always going to be an unsatisfactory experience. That's the nature of dukkha. That's the first noble truth. Again, as long as we continue to try to establish and maintain an ego personality, we're going to be disappointed. We're going to suffer that first noble truth. When we accept the fact that these self-referential views are what's causing us so much confusion, then we can develop that Eightfold Path to its completion and let go of all those views. So the Eightfold Path is in place to help us recognize and abandon all of these views. It's a very simple framework for seeing where we're involved in continued eye-making. The second factor of the Eightfold Path, right intention, then, is the intention to recognize and abandon all self-referential views. The right thinking part of that is the way to acquire right thinking, is through that right intention. And it's an aspect of right thinking to be mindful of these things that we're attaching ourselves to and clinging to. The deep concentration developed through shamatha vipassana meditation directly interrupts clinging mind's desire to remain distracted by interrupting clinging one thought to the next. That very simple process that we do in meditation, recognizing that we're caught up in our thoughts again and coming back to the sensation of breathing, is directly interrupting that process of maintaining the ego self in every thought that we do. The power lies in that simple process of, I'm caught up in my thinking again, let me come back to my breath in a very dispassionate way. That's why I continually emphasize that meditation is primarily for developing concentration, to not be distracted by self-referential thoughts. And the need for the ego personality to continue that with one thought after another thought after another thought. And as you start developing even a little bit of concentration, I think you'll recognize how the ego needs to instill itself in every thought that we have. Every thought is a self-referential thought until we start interrupting that. Once we start gaining a little bit of spaciousness between thoughts, then we can actually see the process occurring. We can see ourselves doing this to ourselves. And it doesn't take a long time to develop that. You know, that word spaciousness is often used to describe meditation. And this is what it really means. There's some space between thoughts that are not self-referential. Our thoughts quiet down. That's another way of saying concentration. You know, a well-concentrated mind is a quiet mind. It's not constantly chasing things. It's not constantly reacting to things. A reaction is a way for the ego personality to maintain control, isn't it? It's quick thinking. It's a way that the ego uses to not allow anything that's not self-referential. Rather than, and just think about having an argument with someone. What does that do? And you get upset. When you get upset, it's because you want something to be different. Right? You're instilling your ego personality in that situation rather than seeing things clearly, that here's someone who's confused and deluded in their understanding, and that's led to their own upset. their own dukkha. A well-concentrated mind will be able to see that and not react to it and remain at peace. It's a very practical application of right intention. Skip that paragraph. The Buddha taught a simple and direct method so that any human being could develop understanding and release in their present lifetime. The Eightfold Path needs no accommodation or adaptation in order to be effective or relevant. The first two noble truths continue as noble truths, and the third and fourth noble truth continue to provide for the cessation of dukkha and release from clinging. It's the ego personality, and this is going back right to the Buddhist time and all those years in between and now. It's the ego's personality to need to add something, whether it's the Buddhist teaching or just something mundane that has occurred, because it's in that adding something that it's able to continue to establish itself. My teacher told me to meditate for 20 minutes every day and develop the Eightfold Path, and I think that's wonderful. But I'm also going to jump on my pogo stick for 300 times a day because I think that's going to help. So you've created an additional identity, and you've done something that's not really necessary, but you now can call it your own practice. You're able to continue to use yourself in something rather than realize that an awakened human being showed us the way to do this without any embellishment. The challenge, what always is until we're awakened, is to not try to embellish the Dhamma or be distracted by our own ego personality's needs. And that gets back to right intention. If we can maintain right intention to recognize self-referential views and resulting actions and abandon those, then we'll continue with that right mindfulness that's necessary to awaken. And when we get caught up in seeing that wrong intention carried me a certain way away from the path, the only thing that's necessary to do is to recognize it and come back into right intention. So it's not like it's not like anybody is watching us, or we're gonna create a sin or be punished by some external force if we fall off the path. Our own suffering tells us that we're off the path. And that again comes back to ehipasika. Come and see for yourself. Do you find benefit as you're developing this path? Is it easing some of your confusion? Is it easing some of the unsatisfactory nature? Are you developing a more peaceful, calm, well-concentrated way of living in the world? Then continue. And continue wholeheartedly. I use that word a lot. So what does it mean? Does it mean that you have to be focused 24 hours a day on the Dhamma and nothing else? No. It means that as best as you can, using right intention, you incorporate these eight factors into your life. As best as you can, you develop a meditation practice to develop concentration so that when you're engaged in wrong intention, you can recognize it. You'll have the concentration and enter and remain in right intention to recognize and abandon all clinging and craving views. That's tonight's teaching. So we're going to go around the room later, but are there any questions about this, the talk tonight, or how to integrate this into your life, or even the importance of integrating it into your life? Everybody got it? Wow. Okay. So we'll meditate for 20 minutes, and then we'll go around the room and talk about this. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths. And holding your back straight but not stiff, your ears aligned with your shoulders and nose aligned with your navel. And holding yourself very loosely, very gently, very lovingly. Allow yourselves to settle into this room. Settle onto your seats. Settle into your bodies and settle into your minds. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. Just get a feel for what that's like. To be mindful of your breath in your body. And while remaining mindful of your breath in your body, notice that thoughts are flowing. We're conscious beings, thoughts should be flowing. The purpose of Shamatha Vipassana meditation is to not be distracted by your own thoughts. So when you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. I'll repeat that. When you find that you're caught up in your thinking again, simply acknowledge that and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. And we'll meditate for 20 minutes. Putting aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. aside thoughts as they arise, remaining mindful of our breathing. not following a thought with a thought, remaining mindful of our breathing. If a persistent thought or feeling arises, stay with it for a moment or two, recognize it as impermanent, and return your mindfulness to the sensation of breathing. And we'll meditate for 5 more minutes. Take a moment to notice the quality of your mind. Be at peace with your mind. And when you're ready, you could gently open your eyes. Welcome, Maura. I think that was just a coincidence, the two people left when you walked in. Maybe not. Well, you have two more weeks left in your penance, and then you can meditate with us. I would love to hear how your meditation practice is going, and if you have any... gained any insights into how when you get caught up in your thoughts during meditation, there's self-referential thoughts, that'd be a good time to talk about it. And I'm gonna put Ram right on the spot and start with you.
Sure.
Good to see you, my friend. But you don't have to do that either.
Well, actually, my practice, as I now have it, is doing well.
Outstanding.
It's actually very pleasant to do 10 to 15 minutes first thing in the morning. So far, nobody has called 911 on me while I'm sitting in my chair not moving.
They may, but that's all right.
Yeah, it's enough experience.
Yeah. You've been able to integrate that pretty easy once you set your right intention.
Intention, and I just realized that the only thing I had to do was, apart from warning my family members not to call the ambulance on me, is to set my alarm clock a little bit earlier and go do it.
Yeah, not that tough.
That's
good.
Once the intention is there. And I had to, you know, and it was good for me to sit here, and in general, actually good for me to sit here and hear other people describe their practice.
Yeah,
it's
so helpful.
That, you know, I had to do something.
Yeah. Yeah, but that's we're so supportive. You know, nobody, I don't know any, very many people anyway, that have done it on their own. I to be honest, I don't know anybody that's been able to develop an effective meditation practice simply on their own.
Without guidance,
no. Yeah, and I get that call an awful lot. I've been meditating for 20 years and nothing seems to. Glad you're here. Anthony, it's good to see you.
Hey, John. I'm keeping up with the meditation. For the past week, it's been very stressful because I have a big trial on Monday and I'm leaving for a business trip tomorrow, so I won't be back until the weekend. So it's this getting all these motions out for trial and the trial brief and the pretrial exchange and figuring out what I'm going to read from depositions and how I'm going to cross-examine that person and direct that person. And so it's been a real right view and right intention have been a real challenge for me, and it's interesting to go from a period of months of just being sort of calm to now I just feel the heart beating a little faster and a little cloudiness and a little pressure in my head, and to just say, you know, that's what I'm dealing with right now.
Yeah,
that's, you know, and you can't stop that, you just can't fall prey to it. You can't,
yeah.
You know, you can't embrace it. And so the thoughts, you know, you get the feelings, and then, so it's almost like I'm meditating to being present, because I'm not, if I'm at my desk working, I can't, you know, sit there and follow the breath through my nose, I have to work. So I'm sort of focusing on being present versus being caught up about what I might be feeling or thinking. But the thoughts are just like the physical feelings, because you feel you get the twinge of, you know, I'm not good enough, or I'm fearful, and then you get the, I'm really good, and I'm going to kill this guy, and it's just like, it just keeps mixing up, you know? and then you realize that neither the good ones or the bad ones are really the reality of it. It's something that you just have to sort of put that spaciousness around and you know, appreciate that it's there and try to move on. So it's that it's almost like a shepherd trying to flock sheep constantly. That's what I feel like.
And the sheep is the Dhamma, trying to keep it around you. That
experience. It usually breaks when I'm in the, you know, a few days into the trial, but until that build up is like it's for 26 years. You'd think I'd be over it, but it's just the way it is.
That is an aspect of the First Noble Truth, and it's just that way. You know, it's a stressful situation, and it shouldn't be any different. But what you have the refined mindfulness to see what's going on and not stick the second arrow and not react to it. This is just what's occurring.
Yeah, I'm throwing all the tactics out there. Well, because you could twist it like, you know, you could say, instead of saying this is really a pain in the ass, I'll just say this is going to be a challenge. You know, if you view it as a challenge and not a pain in the ass, it's not so bad.
Yeah, it's not. And it's what you do.
Because literally, I mean, if this case doesn't settle, I'll be on trial for 30 days in Bergen County.
Wow. Yeah.
So it's not, you know, it's not like a little deal, but I can't make it a big deal in my mind.
Yeah.
Because it just, that would be worse.
And even that, Bergen County is part of worldly causes and conditions. It's nothing that to take personally. It's just the way it is. You know? So I'm glad you're here and thank you for that. Kevin, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. Nice to be back.
Welcome back.
Been sticking with the practice. I've been pretty consistent with it. I've taken it pretty far away from Frenchtown and the Sangha. I've been traveling quite a bit. I think I'm having, you know, when you were saying if you have a persistent thought in your mind, and it's sort of been a distraction. I mean, I was doing some work travel. I ended up in Las Vegas, and it's a complete, you know, on the one end of the middle way, you know, it's just like there for a business trip, doing the thing there and still meditating. And then I sort of had my own retreat and, traveled to Hawaii. Had a completely different kind of distraction there, you know, just like, you know, I get the five clinging aggregates, but, you know, I haven't felt anything, you know, in some of these places that I was. I was meditating, but, you know, to sit through 11, 12 minutes in some of these places was pretty challenging because you're literally like buzzing, you know, it's like this incredible place. And then coming back here and then the different kind of distraction, you know, sort of wrestling with the impermanence of like, wow, I just want to be back there. And now I'm in my day-to-day life again. And you know, the practice is still there, but it's like a different kind of dukkha, you know, it's like, oh, back to the mundane daily, I gotta drive to work and I gotta deal with this. Yeah. And I guess I could probably work on the right mindfulness part and really just, you know, focusing on being gentle with myself because I've done a lot in the last couple of weeks, but practice is still there and I've just been a little distracted in the sitting, in the actual sit the last, you know, 5-6 days, I guess, so. It'll pass, and I'll get through it, and it's impermanent.
Yeah, I'm glad you're here. Hawaii can be it's an incredible place, but it can be a huge distraction. It used to take me weeks to get, it was a time I was spending a lot of time in Hawaii. It would take me weeks just to kind of settle back into being in the East Coast and all that.
Yeah.
But what an incredible place. And I know you went to some of my favorite places, too. So it's good to see you back. Mary Beth, it's good to see you. How are you tonight?
Although I come here and it's the talk and the conversation was so great and the topic tonight was, I really appreciated it. And it creates, aside from being and sitting with the group, the conversation creates something different in meditation. Like I feel it was very interesting tonight to just be seeing like every single thought and being able to recognize what version of like ego thought he was, you know, like kind of like other people were saying, and so it's feels so good to get to that peaceful place of being able to just set those aside and get that some amount of that spaciousness. And, yeah. And when I'm sitting at home, this is better than nothing, but
sure it
sometimes
is.
It's more just like, okay, right, I'm sitting down, because I was going to do that, right, okay, before I do that, yeah. And so I guess it's still, even if it's just here, it's progress. And yeah, so like I said, I really appreciate the topic too.
Yeah, good. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. And that, you know, so many people talk about that, how difficult it is, or at least it seems more effective to meditate with the group. But what you described is a type of insight. It's profound insight to be able to see those thoughts the way you see them, instead of just, we become enamored with our thoughts just like we become enamored with our ego self. And so we just don't want to, we don't even want to look at them. They're just ours. This is the way that I think. And because I think it, it's like that saying, I think, therefore I am. I think this way, and that's right.
Yeah.
And nothing can challenge that until you have a way to look at it in a dispassionate way and say, well, no, that really isn't me.
Yeah, and even to have like a certain amount of consciousness of my thoughts without the real true discernment and right, you know, like all the that comes along with the teachings that I'm getting more and more, it can be even more confusing, because then it's like judging each thought. Like, is that
yeah.
a good thought? You know, and it's like doubling the it's like thought about every thought on top of the thought. But the other thing that's been really great about, deepening my understanding of Dhamma, and you mentioned it tonight, is this idea of about meditation being about concentration. And that definition of the concentration, which we've talked about before, of like, you know, choosing what to think about and not having the thought following the thought, you know, and it may be random. And it reminds me of a book that, it's like awesome book, but, you know, talk about lack of concentration. I've never gotten through the whole thing, but I've heard it twice. But it's called Conversation with the Devil, Napoleon Hill.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I always read it, but it's set up like he's truly having this conversation with the devil, and, you know, getting the devil to reveal all his secrets, and like sort of the bottom line secret to undermining people, you know, is what he calls drifting, and, you know, just kind of getting a connection between that and this idea of, you know, it's the opposite of concentration, like concentration on what we want to be thinking about, what we want our thoughts to be creating, you know, the actions that come out of our thoughts. So it's
It's interesting you mentioned that. Years and years ago, I read everything Napoleon Hill ever wrote. Napoleon Hill, if you haven't heard of him, was a spiritual success writer. In other words, he brought the idea of financial success into the realm of spiritual practice. I guess that's the best way. He wrote that book.
Think and Grow Rich. I think people know.
Think and Grow Rich. You know. And he was contemporary with U.S. Anderson and a bunch of other guys, a precursor to Maxwell Maltz and that self-actualization idea. Really interesting. And he wasn't teaching anything Buddhist, but there's some parallels there. So thanks for bringing that memory back. Bonnie, good to see you.
Nice to see you, John. I'm good.
I'm glad you're here. Mm-hmm. Mike, how are you? Good to see you, Mike.
Good to be here. Without going too deep into my abyss of self-pity, I had a family vacation scheduled over spring break for my daughter, and we were going to go out to Southern California, and we all got sick, and I got the sickest of all of us, and I was riding a roller coaster of self-pity, anger, bitterness, everything, and I didn't want to know from anything. Meditation, my exercise that I had been sticking to and doing well, and just I was in a pretty bad place, ironically, until I started work again this past Monday and all of a sudden got into a routine again.
Mm-hmm.
I guess just laying around, I was mostly bedridden for probably 7 days, and I haven't been that sick in 10 years. And it was just like, okay, I needed this time off from work, we needed this trip, all these things together. Just kind of the floor fell out underneath me. And then when Monday came, Monday morning I meditated again, and I started getting a little bit back into the routine. So I usually go Saturdays, I missed the last two, and I can't attend tomorrow night in Flemington. And I said, I needed to get here tonight. I couldn't wait until next Saturday, so happy to be here.
I'm glad you're here. You know, it's not surprising, but it happens often when our physical well-being changes, everything's out the window, you know. And that's just an aspect of thinking, you know. So I'm glad you're here and you're back on track.
Being gentle with myself, like, yeah. Out the window.
Yeah, well, that's part of it, too. So
yeah.
I'm glad you're here.
I reminded myself of it, but it didn't help.
Yeah. You're almost too far gone at that point. So. I'm glad you're here. Tom, how are you? It's good to see you tonight.
Good. I don't think I have much to say tonight. Just really good talk. A lot to take in.
Yeah.
Practice is good, but I think consistency is something I've got to work on.
Yeah. That's the most important thing. But, you know, you are working on it and you're here. So
mm-hmm.
I'm glad you're here tonight.
Yeah.
Katie, how are you? Good
Hi,
to see you.
Have you ever heard that phrase, I can't help but think?
Yeah. that's the problem. We think we can't help it.
Yeah. I feel like, on one hand, my mind is this beautiful tool, ego included, that is capable of great things. And on the other hand, it paints my true state of being, and it's this constant battle between essence and identity.
Mm-hmm.
But I can see myself going through confusion and disappointment and clinging and craving. But I also feel like that's just part of transformation. And I think my mind wants to master thinking and breathing at the same time. I think there's some resistance, and it probably has to do with control, my mind wanting control.
Yeah.
So there's resistance in meditating. Also, I think when I meditate, a lot of the feelings come up.
Yeah.
You know, from whatever I'm going through, transforming feelings that I might not be familiar with, and that, you know, it's all fear-based. Don't want to feel anything. I'm afraid. I'm vulnerable.
Yeah. It's common, too. Common for many meditators.
But after tonight's talk and meditation, I can see that resistance kind of melting away, and I'm feeling a lot more comfortable. So.
All right, great. The consistency and persistence is really all that's needed to overcome that conditioned thinking.
I really like the word practice.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Yeah.
You know, then the more we do it, the better we get at deepening concentration and integrating the Eightfold Path. But you also develop, in a pretty short time, remarkable insight into what's occurring with you and with your own mind. And it really does come down to how we think. When the Buddha awakened, at that point in his life, he became the world's greatest thinker, I think. A lot of people would agree with me. But not just because he knew how to think. He knew what to think about, what to hold in mind. He knew what was most important to be the underlying view of life. And that's so significant. As we develop that deep concentration, we learn to let go of all the stuff that is unnecessary to have in our heads. And we hold in mind only what's necessary. And that's when we start seeing things clearly. And it's just that process that you described. And Mary Beth was talking about it too. You know, we learn how to think. We learn what to think about, too, what's most important. So thank you. Gail, it's good to see you.
Good to be here. I was reading your article earlier, and I appreciated the talk in the article. And just, you know, if I'm feeling a little off or upset or something, or sad, or I'm more aware, you know, I'll think about what am I clinging to, what do I want to be different, you know, what am I not happy
with.
Just, you know, I'm a little more aware of it, and it makes it a little easier maybe to kind of let it go.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the practical benefits of it. But again, that's exactly how it should be. So. Yeah, I'm glad you're here. Thank you. David, how are you? It's good to see you.
Doing pretty good. I'm meditating twice a day, 15 minutes each time. I thought about distracting thoughts from just thinking what I have to do next, from what I just finished doing. But then I realized that I don't have to continue doing things that produce more stress. So it at least provides a base that I can help make decisions from.
Yeah.
I see the process now.
And you have a framework to make those decisions with now, too.
Right.
Yeah, good for you. I'm glad you're here tonight. Joni, how are you?
How am I? In here, like I shared last week, I can sit either on the chair or on the pillow, focus on my breath. We're talking about stress versus relieving the stress. A situation happened over the weekend. And in the past, it happened, well, actually, it's happened three times. Two of the times, before I got smart enough from learning here, the first two times, I complicated stress with more stress. The third time, I was challenged. And rather than creating more stress, my comment to this individual was, thank you. And I walked out, and by myself, I was very stressful. And I figured the only way to relieve myself of that kind of stress is to stay away from it. Example number two. I've got a girlfriend, and you mentioned the word ego tonight again, and I've been trying not to look at ego, but me being a retired engineer and in mechanical and both electrical, I try to fix stuff, and this situation I've been trying to fix for 5 years, and it's unfixable. And so I start to stay away from this situation. But this morning I ran into a real big situation again. I jumped in the tub at 6 o'clock. I was getting all ready to take a nice soothing bubble bath. And I got such a panic attack. And I said, what am I going to do here? So I said, test. Back to the sensation of breathing. And guess what? I took my bath without a problem. So thank you very much for your teachings.
Joni, you're welcome. I'm glad they worked so well for you. And you had the mindfulness to remember to do it. Yeah. So you've made remarkable progress in just a couple of weeks. I'm glad you're here. Keep it up. Liz, how are you? It's good to see you.
I'm doing well. Doing my practice mostly in the morning. I do have a, like I had said last, I was sick too, so I was out for a couple of sessions. But I have my phone set for an alarm in the afternoon, and sometimes I have to breeze right past it
because
I just can't sit. But I had a challenging situation. My friend did pass who had brain cancer. Passed last night, and I would not have been able to be as present as I was and as available to her family if I hadn't been doing the practice. It turned out to be a very beautiful experience. So it was amazing. So
thank you for sharing that. And that really is the point, isn't it? To learn how to be present with whatever's occurring and not have to run from it. Show remarkable courage, too, to stay with it. Thank you. Maura, it's good to see you.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Sorry to hear about that. Yes.
Thank you.
I don't know how close.
Yeah, it was, well, it just worked out so well. You know, it did, so.
Yeah. And you feel sad, don't you? And that's okay.
Yeah, I'm actually feeling more sad sitting here than I have. Mm-hmm. But it was, it's admitting that you're on someone else's timeline. Mm-hmm. She sort of showed us the way, and for living as long as she lived, she gave everyone time to have a comfort level with the fact that she was dying, mm-hmm. and that we needed to accept that, and she did it with grace as well as her family, so that being invited into that family space at a very intimate time, I'm sure my energy was felt within the space, and I couldn't have had that energy level of being calm and present if I hadn't been doing the work I had been doing. Mm-hmm. There were so many people I talked to that were very good friends who said, I just can't go to visit her. Mm-hmm. And that was really all we could do, was to show up. So to accept the fact that all we could do was show up, and then to bring to that space a sense of calm and acceptance and allowing everyone to experience what they were experiencing without judgment. I'm not saying, you know, it was a perfect scenario, but it made it remarkable. It made it really remarkable, and I hadn't expected that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, again, because you were able to see clearly what was occurring. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Maura?
I was thinking about, you know, a couple of things that people said and things that I've been thinking about, partly due to what I've been listening to and reading to, and part of just a lot of reflection on practice and my life, and I think that at the end of that one talk that I had mentioned to you, it was a talk on not self and how to use, it was a very long, it was a 2-hour talk on how to use healthy sense of self, which I really appreciated a lot, like the self that says there's a human being who awoken and I can do that too, and looking at like what you had mentioned about choosing what to think about, and I've been trying to focus on thinking about what I am doing to increase my awakening and focusing more on that and things that just are not that important, just kind of reminding myself that that's not me, it's not. Yeah, like when you go back to the old thoughts are not me, form is not me, you know, it's just like, how do you use that information? Like, well, that distraction, that's not me. I don't want to continue to follow that, let's just say. And what I, you know, what I can do is do my best to sit, to focus, to remember what's important, you know, from moment to moment, and sometimes forget and say, yeah, I forgot. I really was like out in left field there. And that's I'm going to do my best not to repeat that again. So I was thinking about that he had mentioned, Thanissar briefly mentioned the Rahula Sutta, and where the Buddha talks to his son about how to make decisions about actions and to look at what are the results. Am I causing harm to myself or others before you do it? And then when you do it, you say, well, how, as I'm going through this, how am I feeling? Am I causing harm to myself or others? And then after it's done, how did that work out? Did I cause harm to self or others? And so what I was reflecting on is how much I love the Buddha's teachings in that sense that we often have the right intention and we have the right view, perhaps, but without being able to reflect on, did that really work out the way I wanted it to? Doesn't always... What's the point that I want to say? It's such a dynamic, changing process that there's no right and wrong answer for any of it. And it was something that you said, Liz, and something that maybe Joni had said that made me think of that, where we think we're being kind to somebody or we think we're doing the right thing, but being able to really say, did this sit right with me and did it sit right with the other person? And being able to sit and show up for another person in a time that is difficult for them, and like the amount of satisfaction that I know for my own self that I have felt not being afraid to show up and to be there. It's like those are the reflective qualities and the concentration that we bring to be able to be present with what's going on. And I know that like that I try to focus on. I'm able to do that where I wasn't able to do that before. I'm making progress on the path. As much as, I see where I fall short, to be able to reflect on the great happiness and joy of moments of focused concentration rather than mind wandering, what you had said, Mary Beth, mind wandering creates a lot of unhappiness. And concentration creates such sense of joy and self-esteem, good self-esteem. And I just love listening to everybody talk about Anthony, et cetera, all these beautiful ways that we can use self in a healthy way to move us along. Because I don't know about me, I'm just moving along. Like I am so not there yet, but I know that I'm moving along. So thank you.
Thank you for what you said. It's the Rahulavada Sutta is to me one of the most remarkable suttas for not just the setting, the Buddha teaching his 7-year-old son, but what he taught him at the age of 7. He's teaching him the refined mindfulness that's necessary to fully mature as a human being. When you think about it, dad teaching, not the Buddha, just a dad teaching his son the most important thing that he could teach him. And that's what he did.
In that talk, there was a bunch of psychotherapists there, and they one of the psychotherapists took those instructions to the other psychotherapist and mentioned it, and they said, "Well, if parents had all taught their children like this, there would be no need for psychotherapy."
But the problem is that the parents didn't know.
Correct.
Until now.
Right, no, correct. But, I just thought that was a funny thing.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Frank, it's good to see you.
Good to be here, John. Good to see everybody. Been away for a while.
Welcome back.
Thank you. I like what you said about the suffering, knowing that you're kind of off the path when you're in suffering, because I kind of use the suffering as like bumper guards, like when you're bowling, the bumper guards come up. I know when I'm suffering, I'm taking my life personally, and I'm being totally involved with it on a personal level.
Yeah.
And the practice of meditating twice a day has given me that spacious feeling where I can separate myself from, that it's like a pendulum. My mind is always like swinging from craving and grasping and aversion. It's like back and forth. And it's like when it stops in the middle, I feel peace.
Yeah, wow.
And it doesn't often stop in the middle. And it's like from moment to moment in my day, when I can really concentrate and focus on what is going on with me personally. I work in a very busy environment, and everybody's like eye making and how they try to establish themselves in every certain situation. I can feel it, I can sense it, and when I'm really feeling it, I'm like, all right, you have to separate yourself here. Don't take it personal, because they're just trying to establish their ego. You know, so I always thought that I was an angry person. But this meditation process has helped me realize that a lot of that emotion came from fear.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fear of being involved in something on a personal level. So that gave me a lot of insight into what was going on with me personally.
That's remarkable insight, Frank. That insight to the heart of the matter. I grew up fearful and angry for no reason at all except I was. And that led to all kinds of unpleasant behavior towards myself and towards others. But it was simply based on trying to establish something that I had that couldn't be established, meaning this ego that I was born with. And I struggled with that for so many years.
I struggled with self-view. Like,
yeah.
I viewed myself when I was like always that angry person or whatever. I wasn't comfortable with it because it wasn't my true nature.
Yeah.
So my self-esteem, my self-view of myself was... in a dangerous area.
Yeah.
And I always used to try to escape that feeling through intoxicants, which I haven't had one in 21 months now.
Yeah. Good for you.
So, yeah, I see a lot of growth with myself.
Yeah. Thank you. Maura said that, you know, she said that little thing about the parents. Nobody tells anybody about reality unless you happen to hear about the Buddha's teaching. You know, we're not... Was it you, Bonnie, that said they should teach this in school or teach mindfulness in schools? But really the same thing. Nobody gave me when I was a little kid an understanding of reality, and that's why I was so frustrated and angry, because I was being told something that inside I knew it wasn't true, and I think we all know inside that what we're being presented is not reality, but it's not given to us in a way that makes sense. It's not useful.
I just want to add one thing that stirred something. The fellow I gave your book to, he runs the science department in Bucks County for their school system, high school. And he starts every class with a 3-minute meditation.
Wow, that's great.
And he said that he has seen his kids' test scores, performance go up.
That's remarkable.
Since he started it.
Yeah. Good for him and good for the kids. Thanks, Frank. Lauren, good to see you. How are you?
I've enjoyed being here this evening. I've come up with a little problem in life that I haven't really sorted out in my mind yet, so I can't really speak about it, so I'll just observe silence this time around.
I'm glad you're here.
Thank you.
So, thank you all for a great class. The great insight that you share and support me and you support each other. A few quick announcements. April 23rd, right here in this room, will be a mindfulness-based recovery workshop. There's a flyer out there, info on mindfulnessbasedrecovery.com, and you can certainly talk to me about it. But it's for anybody who suffers from addiction or any compulsive behaviors or those that are involved with anyone like that. Our spring retreat is May 19th to 22nd. It's coming up soon, and there's info on the website about that. And right after that, the Tuesday after our retreat, is the next Donna dinner here at Love and Oven, May 24th. Info on the website about that, too. So, and there's some info about some what you can bring and volunteer opportunities. So I hope you all can come to that. That's just neat. A great party.
It'll be outside, right?
If it's nice out, yeah.
We'll have. So we do like the indoor-outdoor. Very nice.
Yeah.
It's really nice in the spring. It's wonderful in the winter, but it's cool
in the winter. And spread the word about it, please. You know. There was something else, but if I can't remember, it can't be that important. So we'll finish with Meta, my version of Meta. So if you want to gently close your eyes and gently close your mouths and let that become mindful of the sensation of breathing and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any thoughts that are distracting to the past or the future or that have arisen from our talk tonight. And in Metta, the first object of our meditation is always ourselves, and generating feelings of deep love and compassion for the object of our meditation. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. May I be filled with love and kindness. May I be well. May I be peaceful and at ease. May I be happy. And now bring to mind those that you care deeply for, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. And may they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind those you may be in conflict with, difficult relationships, and generating those same feelings of love and compassion for the objects of our meditation. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. May they be filled with love and kindness. May they be well. May they be peaceful and at ease. May they be happy. And now bring to mind each other in this room this evening and all the other members of our Sangha, and extend your awareness outside of this room, across our community, across our planet, across all creation to include all sentient beings, and generating those same feelings of deep love and compassion for all sentient beings. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. May all sentient beings be happy. May all sentient beings be filled with love and kindness. May all sentient beings be well. May all sentient beings be peaceful and at ease. And may all sentient beings be happy. This concludes our Dhamma practice for this evening. Thank you all for being here. Peace.
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.